Good morning. My name is Jeremy, one of the pastors here, and I have just a quick update before we dive in this morning. An update about kind of one of the things that we started just a few weeks ago, that 3 weeks ago when we came back indoor, we did our 9 o'clock service, our 10:45 like we are, and we had also 3 weeks ago started a third service. It was our 8 a.m. service. Because we have a value here at Fairhaven across Harbor Churches that we will stand with those that are most vulnerable. And so for some of those who were most vulnerable, who are most vulnerable, for those who are caring for some of those who are most vulnerable, we created that 8 a.m. space, which was a service where we asked people to keep masks on through the entirety of the service. We've been doing that service for 3 weeks. And in having some conversations with people who have come to the service, we have made the decision that today would be the last day we would do that 8 a.m. service. So we won't be doing that service going forward, but our value still remains. And so we are actively having conversations about how we can continue to live into that value and what will come next. So be listening, be watching. We will be communicating that once we have it nailed down. But just an update, today would be the last day we do that 8 a.m. But for now, we're going to be jumping into week 4 of a 5-week sermon series. We're titling We Create, and I'd like to invite you to turn with me to Mark chapter 5. Mark chapter 5. We're going to have some fun today. We've got some digging we've got to do in Mark chapter 5 today. I'm really excited about it. I hope you will be in just a minute as well. But we're in this series called We Create, where essentially we're asking questions about the church. What is the church called to be? What are we, as Fairhaven, as Harbor Churches, called to be? We have a mission statement that we help people find their way back to God. It's why we exist. In this series, we're asking the question, how do we do that? What kind of church are we? And we're looking at this statement. It's a statement that we create communities of belonging centered on Jesus, where people are formed and sent to be good news. So we started the series with Greg talking about what it means to create. What do we create? Who are we? What have we become? We talked about what it means to create communities of belonging. We talked last week about what does it mean to be centered on Jesus. And then today, what are the rhythms of a life that are centered on Jesus? Today, I want to talk about what it means to be formed and sent, and how those two things go together. And in order to do that, let's go ahead and jump in. Mark chapter 5, we'll start at verse 1. They, Jesus and his disciples, went across the lake to the region of the Gerasenes. Okay. Pause. We have a few things already going on in simply verse 1. We have Jesus and his disciples. They are making a journey. They're leaving a place. They're crossing a lake, and they're going to another place. Minds blown all over the place, right? But in order to understand what's going to happen in the story, I think we need to dive in a little bit to all three of those pieces. Where they're coming from, what they're crossing, and where they're going. So first, let's take a look at a map. We like maps, right? Yes. All right. There's a lot of response. I feel weirdly seen. So this is the Sea of Galilee. This is what they're crossing. The Sea of Galilee is where Jesus will spend the majority of his adult life. Let me show you a picture of the Sea of Galilee. If you're standing, this is a picture taken from what's known as the Mount of Beatitudes out of the Sea of Galilee. The Sea of Galilee is the largest freshwater lake in all of Israel. If you were to walk the beach all the way around the Sea of Galilee, you would walk 33 miles. It's a large lake. It's freshwater. You can see all the way across from everywhere. Jesus would have spent the majority of his adult life, his ministry, around this lake. If we go to the map again, there's a region of the Sea of Galilee where Jesus is going to spend the majority of that time. It's going to be in the top left, the northwest corner, if we put the cities up. There are three cities on the northwest area of the Sea of Galilee in a region called the Galilee where Jesus is going to spend the most of his time. It's Bethsaida, when Jesus calls Peter, Andrew, James, and John, those fishermen, to become disciples. it's Bethsaida, you have Chorazin, and then you have Capernaum. Capernaum is Jesus, where Jesus would have lived during his adult ministry. It's where he would have taught. It's where he would have lived. These three cities are called the religious triangle. They're Jewish, they're religious, they're right there in this Galilee region in Israel. And to show you just a little bit about what life would have looked like in a religious Jewish town, I want to show you a few pictures. First, if we go into Chorazin, Chorazin is this unique little city that's built with all these kind of black rock bricks. It's basalt stone. It's kind of this volcanic stone. But what you see, it's a little hard to see from the picture, but it's essentially a bunch of square rooms. The city is essentially a living community. You're going to share a living space with some of your extended family. Oftentimes these houses are called insulas. There's like two or three sermons we can preach just on insulas. We won't do that today. But the center of town is where people live. And in a good Jewish religious community, you're also going to have a synagogue. This is the synagogue at Chorazin. So you have they live in the center of the city. The city's going to have a synagogue. If we go to Capernaum, I'll let you a picture of Capernaum. This is the site where Jesus would have lived during his kind of adult ministry. On the close end of the picture, you can see again a bunch of kind of what, like the remains of some square rooms. That's where people would have lived. You live in the city. And then that large, impressive structure on the backside, if we go to a picture inside of it, that is the synagogue. That isn't the actual synagogue Jesus would have taught in. That one had been destroyed. This one is not long after Jesus would have taught there. If you're there, you can actually see there's a change in the color of the stone on the outside of it. The base of it is the actual base of the actual synagogue Jesus would have taught in. So you live in the center of the city. Your city has a synagogue. To live in a Jewish religious city, you find a lot of the values about Jewish religious life just in the way they build their cities. They value community, right? They're doing life together. They value simplicity. Nothing about these cities is anything overly impressive. So it's about community. It's about simplicity. It's about generosity. They would live for one another, with one another. So you have community, you have simplicity, you have generosity, and you have faith. Most, if not all, of your Jewish religious cities are going to have a synagogue. It's where you learn. It's where your kids go to school. It's where you do life. So Jesus and his disciples start in the Galilee. Jewish, religious, community focus. They leave the Galilee and they head out across the Sea of Galilee. So we need to talk just a little bit about how they understood the sea, because they're going to understand the sea very differently than we do. How many of you spent time this summer at a lake? A lot of you, right? Like, we live in a world where we go to the lake. We have a free weekend. We go to the water. How many of you have gone swimming in a lake, right? Like, this is something we do. This is not something they would have done in the ancient world. If you went to a lake this summer, what is the thing you notice is all around the shoreline of the lake? There's houses, there's cottages, there's all the things, right? As you look at a picture of the Sea of Galilee, what do you see around the shoreline? Not houses and cottages. There aren't boats out on the lake. Why? Well, the reason today is going to be a little different from in the ancient world. But in the ancient world, they would work on the lake, right? You had some people that served as fishermen. But in a lot of ways, the lake represented so much unknown. Because think of what it would be like to live in a time where you don't have submarines. You don't have scuba gear. You don't have people that have gone down with equipment to map the bottom of the lakes to know how deep it gets and how it. All you know is there's this thing that as you enter it, it keeps getting deeper and deeper and deeper until you can't touch anymore. And what happens if you fall in too deep? You disappear, right? This was not a culture that recreationally swim, especially in Israel. There just isn't enough water to even be able to do it. And so they understood the sea. Much of the ancient world understood the sea as being this kind of gateway to the underworld. They called it the abyss. there actually became this belief that it was actually this in this gateway to the underworld. It was the home of this pagan god called Beelzebub, who's the pagan god of death and flies. This is not something you go to for a nice relaxing weekend, right? So Jesus brings his disciples from the Galilee. They are crossing the lake, and we see this story happens as they're crossing. It says a furious squall came up, and the waves broke over the boat so that it was nearly swamped. Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. The disciples woke him and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" He got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, "Quiet, be still." Then the wind died down, and it was completely calm. He said to his disciples, "Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?" They were terrified and asked each other, "Who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him." Why is it disciples are terrified at this? Like, they've seen Jesus heal people before. They've seen Jesus do miracles before, but now, like, something just happened here that is different. Because here, Jesus calmed the waves. Jesus calmed the sea. And if they understood that, like, they believe the sea is this gateway, like, Jesus has power over not just the physical world. We've seen him actually do that before, but Jesus has power over even the forces of evil themselves. Jesus and the disciples, they get in the boat in the Galilee, in that religious triangle area. They cross the Sea of Galilee, and they are going to a place on the other side. Now, we might read that and just dismiss, like, they just moved across the sea, right? They went from one spot to another spot. But to think that would be to miss so much of what's actually happening in this story. And to see that, we need to go back to our map. So we have the religious triangle on the northwest corner, kind of that top left side. Jesus and the disciples are crossing the sea, and they're going to a city on the southeast. Let's put that up. The city of Hippus. Now, Hippus wouldn't have just been another city. And to see that, I want to put a couple regions up on the screen. We talk about how those first three are in the Galilee. If you notice, we kind of zoom out. You have the Sea of Galilee kind of there on the left side. Religious Triangle is right kind of in that corner of the Galilee. Bethsaida just ekes into the Tetrarchy of Philip. But Jewish, religious, community, simplicity, generosity cross over the lake to the city of Hippus, which is no longer in the Galilee. This is in the Decapolis, which in Jesus' world would have been a completely different world. The Decapolis, what is the Decapolis? Well, deca means 10, polis is city. This is the 10 cities. It's these Roman cities. They are, from the moment you show up in one of these cities, you recognize these are not like the cities on the other side of the lake. These are Roman. They look very different. I want to show some pictures of one of the most excavated, one of the Decapolis cities I've been to. In Bet-Shan, it was ancient Scythopolis. But in Bet-Shan, if you show up in Bet-Shan, it looks like this. The picture doesn't do justice to just how big and how impressive this city is. Can you notice there's that main road? You're kind of looking down in the picture. Can you see the little people down at the end of the road? This thing is gigantic. At the center of the city is not the living spaces of the city. At the center of the city is an intersection between a major northwest and a major east-west road. If you walk these roads in a Decapolis city, you're going to notice on the side there are all these openings to all these different shops. You would have been able to buy and sell things in the Decapolis. You'll walk past some shops, and then you'll realize, like, whoa, that room looks way different from the others. Because along the streets, they would also have these temples to these pagan gods of Rome. The Decapolis would have had a theater very similar to what, this one at least, has a theater very similar to what I showed you last week from Ephesus. You walk into some of the rooms, the detail on the floor from the BCs is beautiful. And then in the middle of town, you show up in the middle of town and there's this really impressive building. It's this big building. You walk in and on the floor you see this. what this would have been. This is seriously impressive. So they would have, they had an elaborate system where they would heat water outside of this building, pipe it into the building. There would have been a tile floor on top of those little pillars. So your hot water would have been piped in underneath the floor. It would have caused steam that would have come up in these channels. They had a first century sauna. Like, this is a first century steam room. How impressive is that? And then where would we expect to find a sauna or a steam room? Like, you find that at the gym, right? Same. They had a gym right next to the sauna, right next to the steam room. Do you find living areas in the major parts of the city in the Decapolis? No. No, you don't live in the city. Their houses were scattered around the hillside because in the Roman cities, in the Decapolis, their values, the values of Rome were all about you. It was about the individual. It was your individual strength. It was your individual beauty. It was especially the individual beauty of the human form. The word gym, how many of you remember when you found out how they used to do the Olympics, right? Like, did Nike create their tracksuits? No, they didn't wear any, right? Because the Greeks and the Romans valued, they prided in the naked human body. It was about the individual. It was individualism, individual strength, individual beauty. This is what they valued. You also would have found a strong military presence. Rome conquered the entire known world with their military. But there was one empire that Rome could never quite conquer. It was an empire that was off to the east. It was known as the Parthian Empire. Why is it we read of so many Roman military people in the land of Israel in the Bible? Because Israel is essentially that easternmost barrier, the border between the Roman Empire and the Parthians. They would have put a whole bunch of people right in this area. The Decapolis actually became a retirement community that if you served in Rome's military and you retired, you could live in the Decapolis. Why? Because then if the Parthians try to advance, they not only have their military in Israel, they also have all of these reserves in these military kind of retirement communities of the Decapolis. Now, with Rome's military, a couple more things, and I promise it'll make sense. Couple more things. They would have divided their military up similar to what we do, right? Like, our military has different divisions. We give them different names. Like, we have the Army, and we have the Navy, and we have Space Force, right? Like, you name the divisions. In their world, they didn't name the divisions, but they would number them. And they didn't call them divisions. They called them legions. A legion of the Roman military would have at least 2,000 people, up to maybe 6,000 soldiers. So 2,000 to 6,000 soldiers, they would have numbered them. The first legion, the second legion, the fourth legion. Rome would have stationed four legions within Israel. And in the Decapolis, we actually found an inscription. Are my slides still? Oh, yeah, good. So we would have found an inscription in the Decapolis of this, which none of us can read, but it's significant because it references the 10th Legion, which would have been the most popular, the most known of all of the Roman legions, mostly because it was founded by and the most trusted legion of a guy by the name of Julius Caesar. This was his. These people were in the Decapolis. And the 10th Legion was a little different. They had a symbol that represented them. A symbol that you actually find is this wild pig, a boar. You have the symbol on the left. You actually find it on coins in the area. An example of the coins on the right. We found little statues of little pigs because this 10th Legion had this symbol of a pig. Okay? Jesus leaves the Galilee with his disciples. They cross the Sea of Galilee. They enter into the Decapolis. Why? Well, because Jesus has something he needs to teach them. And in order to teach them, he has something he needs to show them. But the question then becomes, well, Jesus, like you taught in Capernaum, that synagogue we looked at, like that was home base, that was where you taught. Why not just teach them there? But I think Jesus knows that he needs to do something different. Maybe Jesus' goal is, I think, different than often we think of. See, often I think we think of Jesus as just this teacher of religious things, right? Like, it's Jesus. Jesus teaches us how to pray. Jesus teaches us how to read the scriptures. Jesus teaches us how to understand God. And yes, he does all three. Yes. But I wonder if too often we don't limit Jesus to just teaching those religious things, right? That he was just a teacher of religion, that he was just a master of religion, when Jesus came to teach us and to show us so much more. That yes, Jesus was the master of religion, but I want to argue Jesus was the master of life. How many of you ever had a coach or a teacher where like that coach or that teacher, like they were more than just a coach or a teacher, but like they invested in you in a different way where like you look back and recognize you were shaped because of them. Anybody ever be fortunate enough to have one of those sort of relationships? It's something I remembered a quote a few years back about the guy on the right, this Dean Smith. He was the coach at North Carolina, basketball coach at North Carolina. He died in 2015. And when he died, the guy on the left, a certain Michael Jordan, had a quote about Dean Smith where he said this: "Other than my parents, no one had a bigger influence on my life than Coach Smith. He was more than a coach. He was my mentor, my teacher, my second father. Coach was always there for me whenever I needed him, and I loved him for it. In teaching me the game of basketball, he taught me about life." See, Jesus, he taught his disciples and he teaches us religion, how to pray, how to read the scriptures. But Jesus doesn't just teach that. Jesus teaches all of it. Jesus is the master of all of it, which is, I think, why in John 10, Jesus says this. It says, "The thief comes to steal and kill and destroy, but I have come that they may have life and have it to the full." That Jesus teaches us, what does it look like to forgive when somebody's hurt us? What does it look like to love both the people that are easy to love and the people who are really hard to love? Jesus teaches us, what does it look like to be generous with our resources? Jesus teaches us, like, what do we do in the face of anxiety? How do we navigate when we're facing fear? Jesus teaches all of it. And I think Jesus had something that he needed to teach and something he needed to show his disciples. And in order to do it, he needed to remove them from the Galilee, cross the Sea of Galilee, and enter into that Decapolis. We good? I think we're ready for verse 2. Don't worry. We'll cater in lunch. It'll be great. It'll be fine. We'll get out eventually, right? Ready for verse 2? Verse 2. All right. Verse 2. When Jesus got out of the boat, remember they're in the Decapolis. When Jesus got out of the boat, a man with an impure spirit came from the tombs to meet him. This man lived in the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. For he had been chained hand and foot, but he tore the chains apart and broke the irons on his feet. No one was strong enough to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and in the hills, he would cry out and he would cut himself with stones. So we have this demoniac, and is anybody in town stronger than this guy? No, this guy is the image of strength. Okay, let's go. Next one. When he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and fell on his knees in front of him. He shouted at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? In God's name, don't torture me." For Jesus had said to him, "Come out of this man, you impure spirit." Then Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" "My name is Legion," he replied, "for we are many." Legion, Decapolis, coincidence? Let's keep going. And he begged Jesus again and again not to send them out of the area. a large herd of pigs was feeding on the nearby hillside. The demons begged Jesus, "Send us among the pigs, allow us to go into them." He gave them permission, and the impure spirits came out and went into the pigs. The herd, about 2,000 in number, rushed down the steep bank and into the lake and were drowned. Okay, did all of a sudden these 2,000 pigs become like weird, like they just decided to sacrifice themselves? Or remember what they understood the sea to be in the ancient world. Right, this is this gateway to the underworld. In a lot of ways, they would have understood Jesus is sending these impure spirits back to where they came from. He's banishing them. He's sending them back. He's sending them away. It continues. It says, those tending the pigs ran off and reported this in the town and countryside, and the people went out to see what had happened. When they came to Jesus, they saw the man who had been possessed by the legion of demons sitting there, dressed, which means he previously wasn't, and in his right mind, and they were afraid. Those who had seen it told the people of what had happened to the demon-possessed man and told about the pigs as well. Then the people began to plead with Jesus to leave their region. Jesus goes to this land of the Decapolis. He heals a guy. But I think Jesus is doing a whole lot more. I think Mark is also telling the story that he's critiquing the entire way of life. This guy, is he living in community? No, he's out by himself in the hills. He is the strongest of any of them. He's naked. And Jesus, the story tells us he's not even in his right mind. Jesus heals him and also offers this critique that the way of the Roman ideal of individualism, of putting yourself at the center, that is not the way to live. That is not the best way to live. Jesus is also offering a critique. And the story continues. It says, as Jesus was getting back in the boat. Now, quick pause. Pay attention to this detail. Because Jesus, remember, he got into the boat. He crossed over the Sea of Galilee. He gets out of the boat at the Sea of Galilee. He has this encounter with this demoniac. He heals him. And what does Jesus do? He gets back in the boat to go home. The whole thing he did for one guy. One person. The whole story is about one person. Because that person matters enough. Right? Because Jesus will stop at nothing even just for one person. Which means if any of us, if we've ever felt like we don't have that value, like we aren't worth it, right? And what are the things that we would often measure ourselves up to if we start questioning our value? Probably a lot of the things the Romans valued, right? Our individual strength, our individual worth, our individual beauty. And we start questioning whether or not we're valuable enough, whether or not we're good enough, whether or not we're simply enough. One of the things the story teaches us is that if Jesus would go through it all for one person, he would go through it all for you. Right? There is nobody he wouldn't do it for. This one guy, Jesus does the whole thing for. This guy, his life is changed. His life will never be the same. We see his response next. It says, the man who had been demon-possessed begged to go with him. Jesus did not let him, but said, go home to your own people and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you. So the man went away and began to tell in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and all the people were amazed. A question for you. How much does this guy know about Jesus? Like, has he taken a theology class? Has this guy ever sat through a Bible study? No. He grew up in the Decapolis. This is the Rome. Like, this guy doesn't. All this guy knows is his story. That he had an encounter with Jesus. He met up with Jesus. And his life would never be the same. And Jesus tells this guy, oh, that's enough. Yeah, go tell everyone. See, I wonder too often as we think about what it means to be formed and sent, like, I think one of the things that might stop us from being people who help people find their way back to God, that might prevent us from sharing the news of Jesus, the stories of Jesus, is don't we often wonder, like, well, do I know enough? Right? Like it's about this information. Like, we need to know all the things and then we can go. And Jesus is telling this guy, what you have is a story. You had an encounter with me. Your life would never be the same because of it. Now go out and share that. Because I think Jesus knows that part of our formation happens when we're sent, when we go. That I think you could say that some of the goal of formation is to be sent, to go out on mission. And the goal of being sent, the goal of mission, hopefully is a number of things. Hopefully the goal of mission is that people find their way back to God. And I think there's a goal that happens. I think there's something that happens in the person who's sent. And I think that is that we get formed. And as we're formed, we're sent. And as we're sent, we're formed. And it's this thing that spirals. And so this guy goes, knowing only that he was healed by this guy named Jesus. He was healed and he shares the story. And then what's fascinating is Jesus will come back two chapters later in Mark 7, and we see this. It says, then Jesus left the vicinity of Tyre and went through Sidon down to the Sea of Galilee and into the region of the Decapolis. There, some people brought to him a man who was deaf and could hardly talk, and they begged Jesus to put his hand on him. Why would they bring somebody who needs to be healed to Jesus when he shows up in the Decapolis? Could it be because they've been hearing the story of somebody who met Jesus and was healed? One person turns into some people. And then half a chapter later, in chapter 8, verse 1, he's still in the Decapolis. We read this. It says, during those days, another large crowd gathered. And since they had nothing to eat, he'll end up feeding 4,000 people on a hillside. Jesus went across the lake for one person because that one person mattered. That one person responded to Jesus' call. That one person turned into some people, which turned into another large crowd we know becomes 4,000 people on a hillside because one person went. To be formed is to be sent, and to be sent is to be formed as we continue to walk this process of becoming more and more like Jesus. But there's one more thing I like in this story. Can I give you a PS? There's one more thing I like in the story. And it's that the demoniac isn't the only person being formed in the story. He's not the only person that's being formed in the process of being sent. I want to show just a list of verses. Pay attention to the pronouns of kind of the action words that went through the story. So chapter 4, verse 35, before they crossed over, they said, let us go to the other side. It's the disciples. It's plural. Let us go. Then they, the disciples, took Jesus along. They, on the lake, were terrified. They went across the lake. When Jesus got out of the boat. And then when the demoniac, when he saw Jesus from a distance, and then as Jesus was getting back in the boat, and if we continue, we will then read that they crossed over to the other side. They crossed over. They were afraid. They got to the other side. He got out. He had an exchange with the demoniac. He got back in. They went back to the other side. Which begs the question, where were they when he was out doing that? It feels like they never got out, right? What did the disciples know about Jesus? They knew all kinds of stuff about Jesus. They had followed Jesus. They were his disciples. And yet, when the call came to go to the demoniac, to this land of the Decapolis, they didn't get out of the boat. They were formed, but they hadn't recognized yet that they were also sent. And what will happen the next time they come across? Will they stay in the boat? No, the next time they'll get out because they saw what Jesus was doing. Because that process of formation, it never ends, right? It's not like we get educated, we get the right number of information, and then our formation ends, and then we start. No. Like, that process of being formed is an ongoing thing that is continually happening in us, that Jesus is forming us to be more like him. And part of the way he forms us is in our being sent. And some of our being sent happens out of our formation. And in the whole process, the whole thing is to become more like Jesus. And so my invitation for you today is to enter that cycle, right, of formation and of sending. And if you're in a spot where you want to jump into a formation, we would love to have you jump in. We have small groups that are going to be, our registration is going to be closing today. We'd love to have you sign up. Connect with me. Connect with Luann at Guest Services. If you jump onto our website at fhchurch.org and go to adults, you can let me know that you're interested in joining a small group to continue that process of formation. And then for people who are sent, maybe you've had it on your heart, like you feel like maybe you should give yourself to something, but you've always wondered if you know enough, or if you can, or if you're good enough, if you're able to do it. May you hear Jesus saying, simply just go. You have your story. You've met Jesus. Go, trust him, and trust that as you go, he will continue to form you in the process. If you're somebody who would like to step in, we've got a number of ways that you could do that. You could sign up to help out with kids. You could help pack backpacks for hand-to-hand. Brian made an announcement that maybe the first step is simply to open your backyard, to open your yard and invite your neighborhood in so that you can develop relationships with those that you live next to in a backyard fall fest. But may we be a church. May we be a church that is a community of belonging that is centered on Jesus, where we are formed and sent to do what? I will talk about next week. Would you pray with me? God, we thank you for today. We thank you for this space. We thank you for the scriptures and the way they speak across generations and years and cultures and places, and they speak right to us today. God, we pray. We pray that we would continue to say yes to the work that you are doing inside of us, to form us and to send us as you shape us more and more into the image of your Son. That we become less, that he becomes more. Until we realize that the best us is the us that we are in him, the us that we are in you. We pray this all in Jesus' name. Amen.